So good evening, everyone. Again, thank you for coming again, taking the effort to come in a rain, so forth. So we'll start with again right motivations. Before that, trying to quiet our mind, settle down our mind. Try to keep your back straight. Helpful to our mind to be more alert, awake. Try to let go of any being too uptight. Make yourself relaxed, comfortable. And feel the weight of your body on cushions or on chair. Allow your breath to flow naturally. Observe and watch the breath mindfully for a few moments. Simply just observing and being aware. Once your mind is settled down, then we can reflect, contemplate. In order to be greatest help, benefit to all sentient beings and oneself, I must achieve my highest potential, the fully awakened state, as soon as possible. Without achieving fully enlightened state, even though we can be help and benefit, it will be very limited and will not be the greatest benefit and help. Therefore, I must achieve that fully awakened state as soon as possible. To achieve that fully awakened state, I must cultivate highest level of bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing the ultimate truth, the emptiness. And to develop those qualities, I must reflect, contemplate, meditate and practice correctly, continuously. And for that, I need to be reminded of those practices all the time. Therefore, I'm going to listen and engage in the discussions and the reflection, contemplations. May all the act of coming here together to listen, to discuss, reflect, contemplating everything that we do during 24 hours, this week, this month, this year, this life, in all future life until we achieve fully enlightened state. Everything that we do through body, speech and mind, may they all become cause and condition to achieve fully awakened state. May all they become cause and condition to increase and improve for the bodhicitta mind and wisdom realizing the ultimate truth. And may all them become cause conditions for the happiness of others and oneself. Refuge in bodhicitta. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create to listen to the Dharma, may I become Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Sankhe Shuddham Sogye Thonangla Chancho Bhaktu Dhani Chapsochi Dhaki Chushe Nyebe Sonamke Dola Penje Sankhe Dungwa Sho Sankhe Shuddham Sogye Thonangla Chancho Bhaktu Dhani Chapsochi Dhaki Chushe Nyebe Sonamke Dola Penje Sankhe Dungwa Sho. So yesterday we just kind of talked about what are the two truths, you know, according to the different school of thought of Buddhism, and then little bit, and then we talked about also, especially from the Madhyamika or the middle way school, from the middle way school of point of view, the two truths. We also talk and discuss about, in order to achieve the fully awakened state, you need to have correct realization and direct and correct realization of ultimate truth. And in order to have that wisdom realizing the ultimate truth directly or perceived directly, then it need to depend on the conventional truth, the conventional truth being as the like the ladder or as the method for the ultimate truth, the wisdom cultivating of the ultimate truth to arise. Therefore, understanding what truth is so important in order to achieve, you know, nirvana or total freedom from the samsara. We also talk about, you know, without a conventional truth, we wouldn't be able to function in our everyday life. Without understanding, without the wisdom or the conventional valid cognizers that perceives the conventional reality or truth, without that, then, you know, we will not be able to function properly in our everyday life. When there is a, you know, dark cloud and when a storm, dark clouds, when there is a wind, everything's, you understand there will be a storm. And through that understanding of the storm and the possibility of all rains, everything's, then it helps us to prepare ourselves better. And that is because of that, the valid cognizer that perceive the valid conventional reality. And that is what directs our everyday life, you know. So we talk a little bit about the conventional truth and the importance of that, and also the valid cognizer that perceive the conventional truth. And within the conventional truth, of course, a different school of thought have slightly different, but in Chandrakirti Prasangika point of view, you know, there's a false, you know, conventional truth according to the worldly or ordinary beings, and there is real or true conventional truth according to the worldly or ordinary beings, when you kind of different kind of conventional truth. Example of conventional truth, which is a false, which is a conventional truth, but which is a false according to the ordinary beings. Ordinary being here means those who have not understood the realized emptiness. And the example of such truth, conventional truth, are such as the image of the, let's say, the moon in the still legs, or image of your face in the mirror, or dream state, and like the movie, you know, the echo sound, you know, the mirage, or the magic tricks. And those are examples of that, because those are conventional truth. They are not ultimate truth, they are conventional truth. And they are false according to those ordinary beings, those who have, they are ordinary beings in sense that they have not had the realization of emptiness. And it is a false because their understanding is a deceptive, all of them as being deceptive. Even they don't have understanding of emptiness, but they still know all this appearance from those are deceptive. They know in mirrors there's appearance of water from this certain distance to a certain condition, but they know it's no real water, it's just a mirage, the appearance not. In a dream, you can dream something, but they know it's just a dream, it's not really happening. The image of the moons in the leg, it appears it's in the leg, but they know it is not in the leg, it is just a reflection. Same with the your reflection in the mirror. Same with the echo sound. You know, even the echo sound, even though it appears coming from this side, but they know it is not from here. So because they understand it as a deceptive, that the way it appears and the way they exist do not concord. So therefore that is known as, you know, conventional truth. It's because it's conventional truth and unreal or deceptive conventional truth according to those ordinary beings. And then other example of real or truth, conventional, not false, conventional truth is, will be, you know, the iPad, the mic, what do you call it?
Microphone,
you know, the tables, the flower, the cup, all everything that, you know, me, you, my body, my mind, all of that. And because all of them are conventional truth, they are not ultimate truth. Okay? Within the, all the existing phenomena, it could be either conventional truth or either ultimate truth. Anything that exists but which is not ultimate truth, then they are all conventional truth. So it is conventional truth, but it is not false or deceptive according to the ordinary beings who have not understood emptiness, you know. So to them, this table appears as inherently existing table, and they perceive it as inherently existing table. You know, the microphone, the iPad, the flower, the cup, everything's. So they cannot see the discord between the appearance and the reality, or the thing exists. you know, they see the way it appears, they see it as reality being that case. In the other case, the example previous one, they see the appearance and the way they exist. There's a discontent, you know, they see the appearance is not true to reality. But in these cases, they cannot see the appearance is not true because they believe the object exists the way it appears. So therefore, that is, you know, true or non-deceptive, conventional truth according to those ordinary beings. So with that, maybe I might kind of conclude with the talk on conventional truth. Then I want to talk a little bit on ultimate truth, the other truth. Ultimate truth, you know, yesterday I quoted a little bit from some of the sutras. Similarly, based on those sutras, Nagarjuna in his Root of the Wisdom or Fundamental Treatise, he describes the ultimate truth as being, you know, not something that you can experience, the direct experience of that truth by hearing words from others. It is something that need to be perceived by your own awareness directly, you know. And also it's a peaceful, you know, because it's empty or pacified of its own nature. Also he explained that the ultimate truth being, you know, empty of mental elaborations. Also he explained about, you know, the ultimate truth being non-conceptional, you know, absent of conceptional thoughts, you know, which analyze this is this, this is that, and all of that is free from all of those conceptions, you know, free of all conceptions. And also is empty of, you know, diversity, because in ultimate truth, all is same taste, all in same. In ultimate truth, there's no differences. You know, there's a differences in conventional truth, but no differences in ultimate truth. Conventional truth, small and big, you know, good and bad, me and you, us and them, table, flowers, there's all this diversity. But in ultimate truth, there's empty of that. Everything is just merely absent of inherent existence. That's all it is. And in that nature, that everything's being empty of inherent, absent or empty of inherent existence or nature, there's no differences. So therefore, that is why you see in some of the Buddhist prayers or practice or description of in emptiness, all is one taste. Whereas in conventional, there is many tastes. So that is what Nagarjuna describes of the ultimate truth. Similarly, you know, Baba Bhika, you know, another great Madhyamika masters, he also describes similarly in his writing, you know, the ultimate truth or suchness is that is free from all the nets of the conceptual thought, you know, such as this is permanent, this is impermanent, this is existing, that is not existence, this and that, you know, all different identifications that we make. It's free from all of that in emptiness. The ultimate truth is free of all of that. And also is similar like Narayana, he also told, you know, is beyond the elaborate of the conceptions, therefore is peace, you know, and it is something that need to be perceived by the awareness directly. It is not something that can be understood or perceived directly from hearing from others. And also, as also in yesterday in Sutra, it says, you know, it's free from the letters and so forth. It means it's something that cannot be described by the words, you know. It can be described close, but not exactly true nature. It is something that one has to experience is to really understand that. And it's like a space or sky which is free from all the stains. And again, you know, it's free from the nature of that, it's free from all the clouds of the temporary afflictive emotions. So that is how it is described, the ultimate truth. So basically, the ultimate truth is the emptiness. The emptiness. The emptiness is called ultimate truth because it's the object of ultimate wisdom. The Arya wisdom that perceives the emptiness directly. And that wisdom, the Arya wisdom that perceives emptiness directly, is the ultimate wisdom or supreme wisdom, and emptiness or object of that wisdom, therefore, is ultimate truth. And that wisdom is supreme or ultimate because that wisdom is the one that cuts root of all the samsara and all the sufferings. And that wisdom is the one that lead to nirvana or liberations. Therefore, that wisdom is known as ultimate or supreme. The conventional, the wisdom that relies the conventional truth, you know, cannot cut the root of samsara completely or directly and completely. And therefore, you know, whereas this Arya wisdom that perceives emptiness directly is, and since it's object of that, then is objects, therefore is called ultimate reality or ultimate truth, you know. Also in some, it also explains the conventional truth, when you come in contact with those objects, it gives rise to attachments. Whereas this wisdom, realizing emptiness directly, when you come in contact with that wisdom, it doesn't give rise to afflictive emotions. Therefore, again, is a ultimate, you know, the conventional reality. When your mind comes in contact, that it gives rise to afflictive emotion, whereas that wisdom doesn't give rise to those arising of coming in contact with that wisdom doesn't give rise to arising of afflictive emotions. And therefore, again, that is why also sometimes it's known as the ultimate. Also, it is called ultimate truth because the appearance and the mode of existing, or the way they exist, concord. Unlike the conventional truth. Conventional truth, the appearance and the way things actually exist, there's a gap. There's a concord. They are not same. Therefore, it's deceptive. Whereas the ultimate truth is not deceptive because the way it appears, the appearance, and the way they exist are in the same. And so then it comes, the way it appearance to what? Then it has to be the appearance to the mind that perceives them directly. Okay? The mind that perceives the conventional truth directly, such as I get as with my eye consciousness, okay? Body cognizer that perceive this flower, okay, and this eye consciousness, the body cognizer, eye consciousness, which perceive this flower, the flower that appear to this eye body cognizer, that it appear inherent existence. There is that appearance, but in reality, the flower does not exist inherently. That is not how flower exists. That is not the mode of existing of the flower. So there is a difference. It's not same, you know. And so therefore, that is why conventional reality is known as deceptive, you know, false. Because there is a difference between the appearance and the way they exist. An appearance to what? The appearance to the consciousness that perceives the object directly. Whereas the emptiness, the ultimate truth, to the mind that perceives it directly, the mind which perceives emptiness or ultimate truth directly is the wisdom that realizes emptiness. That is what it is. Okay? The wisdom that perceives emptiness directly is the one that perceives the ultimate reality directly. To that mind, to that perceptions, the emptiness which is perceived, it appears as non-inherent existence, and that is how the emptiness exists. Or the object exists. And so therefore the way appearance of that subject, the mind, and the way the object exists is same. There's no differences. There's no discord. Yeah. Basically it is not same, there is a difference. You know, and so therefore the ultimate truth becomes undeceptive. It's undeceptive and not false truth. And therefore, again, that's why it's also known as ultimate truth, because it's not deceptive. So then talking about the ultimate truth or the emptiness, you know, then in presentation of that emptiness or ultimate truth, then, you know, in most of those sutras as well as the commentaries, you know, they present the emptiness of the person, the emptiness of phenomena, and then emptiness of emptiness. Sometimes, you know, it can be presented as a 16 emptiness different due to a different object of the emptiness. And when it is kind of summarized in four emptiness, and when there is even contents, then is contents and two emptiness, emptiness of the person and emptiness of the phenomena. And in presenting, you know, the emptiness first of the self, of the persons, and then, you know, present the emptiness of phenomena, starting with, you know, your own aggregates, you know, because those are the objects that we get in touch and we relate every day. What aggregate we see, we interact with that every day, and therefore there is more grasping to it every day. Therefore, there is more likely to have attachment and all of that based on that. So the, then, you know, in presenting the emptiness or ultimate truth of the phenomena, then, you know, the emptiness of your physical aggregate, the emptiness of your mental aggregates. And then slowly it includes all other phenomena, both condition, non-conditioned phenomena, and all the phenomena. And as in one of the sutras mentions, you know, and also in other commentaries, the problem for us is not having realization of the emptiness of one object. If we have realization or emptiness of one object, then it's easy to have a realization or emptiness of all the other objects. When you apply that same reason to other objects, then you can, you know, it doesn't take much effort or anything to have a realization of the emptiness of all phenomena. The problem is not being able to have realization, emptiness of even one object, and that is the thing, you know. So then in presentations of the emptiness of the self and phenomena, you know, then when you use many different ultimate analysis, you know, different ultimate reasoning and logics, or ultimate analysis and examinations, you know, when you try to analyze with that, then, you know, whether it's the self or whether it's the phenomena, are not being able to find by that ultimate analysis, you know, or not being able to find in such analysis, ultimate analysis. And when you cannot find with such ultimate analysis, even though there is appearance of objects as existing inherently or by itself, but if you try to analyze, is it just an appearance, or does the object exist the way it appeared? And when you do a more deeper analysis of ultimate analysis, more deeper analysis, then, you know, it cannot be found. And that the empty of being able to find but in such ultimate analysis is the emptiness, which is the absence of inherent existence. If there is inherent existence or existing form is by itself, it should be able to find by such analysis, but it cannot. So when we talk about analysis, we can talk about two kinds of analysis: conventional analysis, ultimate analysis. Okay? Conventional analysis, you know, am I feeling good today or not? You know? Was it raining today or not? You know? Did I eat today or not? You know, all this kind of analysis is analysis, you know, but conventional analysis. ultimate analysis is actually going more deeper. It's not about whether I was feeling good or today, or whether I went today to market or not. Who is the I? Going, trying to find who is the I, which we think whether I went to city or not, you know, whether I was feeling good or not. Who is that I? Going more deeper, it's not about that, you know, but it's going deeper. In conventional analysis, we don't try to really analyze and find about that person. It's basis on that there's a person, then we analyze whether you went there, whether you eat or no, whether you feel good or not, all of that. An ultimate analysis is, you know, not being satisfied with that just appearance, but actually, who is that? You know, is there the I, is, you know, the I that appear truly existence on the basis of that, then where we analyze all others, actually, is there a truly I that the way it appears or not? And that becomes ultimate analysis because it goes much more deeper analysis. It's the same. They analyze whether this table is big or small, whether this table is nice or good, whether this table is valuable or not valuable, you know, whether this table is, all these are analyzed, this is more conventional analysis. But ultimate analysis, what is actually the table itself? Before, what we analyze is good or not, you know, small or big, whatever different analysis we do, the very basic, even what is actually the table itself? And that is what the difference between the analyzed conventional analysis and ultimate analysis, you know. And when you do that ultimate analysis, when it cannot be found, then it is clear, you know, that it is empty of existence, absolutely or ultimately or inherently. And that the absence or the empty of absolute existence or ultimate existence or inherent existence is the ultimate truth. That is the ultimate truth, because there is no higher truth than that. Every object has many truth, many different truth or nature, you know, impermanent. For example, this table is changing momentarily. That is the nature of this table. It's the reality of this table. It's truth about this table. This table is able to function to hold all these objects. Okay? This, the ability coming together when you put all together, and this are just functioning to hold these objects and function to all. That is the nature of this table. It's the function of this table. It's the reality of this table. Okay? So this table can have many different levels of realities. But among all this reality, the most supreme or ultimate reality is this table being absent of inherent existence. And that is because when you have realizations of that, the table being absent of inherent existence, then it cuts very root of all the grasping, you know. With others' realities or the nature, even you, when you have understanding or realization, direct realization or understanding of such nature, it doesn't cut the very root of the grasping or the grasping itself. So therefore there is something higher than that, the nature, when you have that realization of that, that can cut by the root of all these delusions and the grasping. Therefore, again, that's why that kind of analysis is for ultimate analysis, and that reality, that nature is known as ultimate reality, ultimate nature. And in terms of that analysis, you know, then you find many different analyses. The analysis, you know, whether the object is, you know, one with the parts or separate from the parts. In other words, whether it can be, whether the object can be found within the part of that object or outside of those objects. And when you do that analysis, then again it becomes clear that the object cannot be found either within the parts of that object, nor separate and outside, nor separate outside from those parts. You know? And then when you cannot be found either in that way, then it's clear that the object does not exist by itself or from its own side. If something exists from its own side objectively or by itself, then it should be, when you do that analysis, it should be able to find either within the part or outside of the part. And so therefore, you know, it's empty of inherent existence, empty of existence from its own side. You know. Also you see the analysis of, so in terms of the persons, you know, whether the person or the self can be found within the aggregates or outside of aggregates. You know. And if you do that kind of analysis, it cannot be found within the physical aggregate, nor it can be found within the aggregates of feeling, discriminating mind, compulsional factor of mind, nor in consciousness. Nor you can find the self outside of your aggregate. If you take away your aggregate away, you know, just like, you know, if I take all this, still I can point out the cup. You know, after taking all of this away, still I can confound. After taking all the aggregates away, you should be able to find the self or I. But neither you can find that. And therefore, when we cannot find either within the aggregates or outside of aggregate or separate from the aggregates, then it's clear that it do not exist by itself. You know, from its own side. Therefore, it's empty of existing from its own side or by itself or inherently. Also, you know, Nagarjuna used other, many other reasons, you know, the four reasoning, whether the sprout or any of those any of the impermanent condition phenomena, whether it exists without depending on cause or it depends on cause. You know, if it is, it arises without cause randomly, then anything can arise anytime. You know, anything can arise anytime, anywhere, because it doesn't depend on any particular cause. If it exists by depending on cause, then it does it, you know, arise or exist by depending on coming from, by depending on is by itself, others, or both. And then, you know, negate how it is not existing with different reason logic from by itself, nor from others, inherently others, nor both. And therefore, with that kind of four analysis, when you do that four analysis, you know, you cannot be found. And therefore, again, is empty of inherent existence, truly existence. Or the analysis of the chariot, you know, seven analysis of the chariot. You know, I think that one, Nagarjuna does five analyses in his precious garland. And then two analyses was later added by Chandrakirti, and then become those seven analyses. in Nagarjuna's precious garland, and again the analysis, you know, whether chariot is, you know, one, you know, identity with its part, or is it, you know, totally separate from the analysis, separate from the path, you know, or does the chariot, you know, possess within the path, you know, does it, the chariot depend on the path inherently and other way around, you know, or is this the shape, the chariot, is this the collections, the shape, you know, when that kind of seven analysis, when you do that kind of seven analysis, again, you cannot be found with any of those analyses. It's neither one identical, neither they are completely unrelated separate, neither it can be possessed, the chariot can be possessed within the you know, the parts, nor they are dependent, like, you know, the cup and the objects in that cup, you know, when you take out the garlic from the cup, still the garlic is there. I mean, still garlic is there and cup is there. So when you take away the aggregates, can there be the self? It doesn't, you know. Nor when you take away the self, nor there can be aggregates. They are mutually dependent arisings, you know. So therefore, neither is depending that way, nor the collections of those parts of the chariot, nor the shape of that chariot. And then when you do that, then you cannot find in any of them, then what is the chariot or the car, you know? And then the car or the chariot is merely imputed on the basis of all those parts coming together and it has certain functionings. On the basis of all parts coming together, put in certain ways, fixed in certain way, and it has certain functionings. On the basis of that, then the so-called the chariot, the so-called car or the vehicle is merely imputed, merely designated. There's nothing more than that. Therefore, you know, the aggregate, or the self, is empty of, you know, inherent existence, or existing by itself. And that is the ultimate truth. And you find many, many other analyses, you know. Also, the aggregate and the self and the aggregate, all phenomena are empty of inherent existence, or empty of existing by itself from its own side, because they all are dependent arisings. Because they all are dependent arising. Something which is dependent arising cannot be something that can exist by itself. If something exists by itself, it means it should be able to exist without depending on any other cause, condition, other factors. But again, there's no phenomena that can exist by itself without depending on other cause, condition, or factors. Therefore, all phenomena, the self, the aggregates, and all phenomena are empty of existing by itself, you know, existing by from its own side. From its own side means to be able to exist by its own side without depending on other factors. That is what it means by its own side, isn't it? something existing by depending on other factors, and something existing by itself or by its own side is contradictions. Contradictory, it cannot be both. But if you analyze this, everything is dependent arising. Since everything is dependent arising, therefore everything is empty of inherent existence, empty of existence by itself from its own side. And that is the ultimate truth. The absence or empty of such inherent existing or truly existing or exist from its own side is the ultimate truth. And when one perceives that ultimate truth directly, you know, then delusion has no grip on our mind. The delusion has no grip on our mind. It completely destroys all the delusions with that wisdom perceiving or realizing the ultimate truth directly, you know, starting with a gross level of delusion to subtle to more subtle level, and then completely eliminate all of them, and then, you know, completely lead to the ultimate happiness of nirvana. And such wisdom that perceived, when we talk of the ultimate truth, sometimes it can be understood. Sometimes it refers, mostly, it refers to the object of that wisdom, okay, which is the emptiness. But in some cases, it can refer to the wisdom itself, especially in, you know, some tantric higher teachings. So sometimes it can refer to the actually subject, the wisdom itself. And when we refer to the subject, the wisdom itself, that perceives the emptiness directly, you know, and in that meditative equipoise, you know, then in that it's empty of all dualistic appearance in that mind. There is no appearance of inherent existence of the objects. There is no appearance of the dualistic of subject and objects. And there is no appearance, even the conventional objects. If you are meditating on emptiness of the self, or meditating emptiness of the mind, or meditating emptiness of your physical form, in that deep meditative state, not only there is no appearance of whether it's the mind or the self or the body, whatever you are meditating on emptiness, not only there is no appearance of that object as inherent existence, but there is no appearance of the subject which is meditating and the objects which is appearing to that mind, nor there is appearance of even the object itself, the conventional in the mind, that meditative equipoise, the mind which is meditating on emptiness or perceiving the emptiness of the mind, there's not even an appearance of even the mind itself, you know, so it's free from all the dualism. What appears in that mind is just emptiness, nothing more than just the emptiness. Just the emptiness. Therefore, you know, in that wisdom, in that mind, you know, is free from all the conceptual thought in that moment, free from all the conceptual elaborations. And there is no grasping. And so when the meditator or practitioner, when they come out of such meditative equipoise, then, you know, it is mentioned by the power of that meditations, By the power of that meditation, when the meditator is in such a deep meditative state of emptiness, without any dualistic appearances, is so powerful when they come out of meditative state. By the power of that meditation, everything, when they come out of meditations and engage into daily activities, and then, you know, everything, object appear to them, you know, you started to see, you started to hear, smell, you know, taste, feel, but all the objects of your object appears more like illusion state, more like dream state naturally by the power of that mind. Through the power of that meditation of the mind, then everything that you experience, the object appear as more like a dream state, more like illusion state. And because of that, then again, you have no grasping, because you don't believe it as so true and real. So of course, in deep meditation, there's no grasping at all, because there's not even appearance of any objects, except in the emptiness itself. But even when you come out of that emptiness, meditative, and when you engage in the world, and even when you experience different objects by different sense and mental consciousness, but then the way the object appears by the power of that as more unreal, more like a dream state, more like that, and so then again, you know, you don't get grasping to that. Of course, that is for those who have direct perception, and who have, for us who doesn't have that, then we have to remind ourselves they are like illusions, like a dream state. We have to remind ourselves all the time. For them, they don't have to remind, the object appears that way to their mind by the power of that mind, meditative state. So for those who have not have that direct perception or realization of emptiness, then, you know, when you were engaged in the world during the, you know, both meditations, then, you know, we try to remind ourselves, you know, even though whatever we are experiencing, even though they appear so real, so true and so real, but reminding, you know, it's not like that. It's like a dream, the appearance. That is not how the object exists, the way it appears, you know. And so thereby not being deceived by the appearance, by understanding that appearance is like a dream state, like an illusion. And as we mentioned yesterday, the two truths are like the, you know, different aspects of same nature, you know. And like as mentioned, two sides of the same coin, you know, it's the same nature of a phenomena, but two different aspects of nature of that phenomena. So that is, so depending on arisings, you know, by depending on many cause, conditions, factors, you know, and having certain functionings, is the conventional truth of that phenomena. And then that phenomena being empty of inherent existence, empty of truly existence, is the ultimate truth of that phenomena. And those two truth coexist without contradictions. And of course, you know, there is a there are those truth are in the same nature, but they are not identical, you know. And so if they are identical, they are false. If they are not truth, if they are not same nature, therefore false in the sutras. But I don't think I need to go in that. And again, sometimes too much information scatter your mind. Especially when you have too much in a short, in a very short time, you know, too much to digest, too many informations. So I don't want to go in that at the moment, you know. So in the nature or in the reality, those two truths coexist simultaneously within each of those phenomena without contradictions. Also, when we practice, also when we practice, then also we should be able to see that true truth. That is not only how it exists in reality, but also when we meditate and when we practice in our path, we train to see them again, you know, not mean contradictions, but, you know, to be able to see simultaneously. As Nagarjuna mentioned in his commentary on the Bodhicitta, he's praising the Buddha by saying, you know, while everything is empty, empty or inherent existing, at the same time, it confirms the law of cause and effect. And that that teaching, that understanding is, there's nothing more amazing than that. There's no more wondrous than that wonders, as it mentions. In other words, by seeing those not two, in understanding those two are not contradictions, the more deeper understanding and correct understanding you have on emptiness, the more faith you have in the law of cause and effect, the more certainties in law of cause and effect, the karma increases. It's not the other way around. When we feel we have understanding of emptiness, but our faith and our certainty or certain into karma decreases, then that means there's something wrong. That means there's something wrong with our understanding. That means we are going more nihilism. We are going to more nihilisms. When you have correct understandings of emptiness or the ultimate truth, then you know your faith in the conventional reality increases, the conventional reality of cause and effect of the karma. And so similarly, Lama Tsongkhapa mentions, you know, when you understand emptiness, it doesn't contradict dependent arisings and the law of cause and effect, karma. And when you understand the law of cause and effect, dependent arising, it doesn't contradict the emptiness. Not only that alternately, but you should be able to understand both simultaneously. The moment you see law of cause and effect or dependent arising, at the same time, you are able to see emptiness, and therefore there's no grasping. While you see the law of cause and effect and the functioning of law of cause and effect, at the same time, because you see the emptiness, therefore there's no more grasping to the objects. While you see the emptiness, at the same time, because you see the dependent arisings, and therefore your assertment towards the karma increases, not the other way around. And when we are able to do that, when you see dependent arising, to be able to see emptiness, when you see emptiness, to be able to see dependent arising simultaneously, and then that is when you have really found the final thought of the Buddha's the right view, the emptiness, the ultimate truth. And with that understanding, then, you know, it helps you to develop wisdom as well as the compassion. Because you see emptiness of the other persons, and you see the emptiness of the sufferings of the sentient beings, the suffering itself. At the same time, you see due to cause and condition, there is suffering, and therefore there are sentient beings who are suffering. And therefore you can feel their pain and suffering, and therefore it allows you to feel compassion. You know, if you just see the emptiness, and if you cannot see the dependent arising, then you cannot see their pain, sufferings, and the sentient being suffering, then there's no space to feel compassion and to develop the mettled sight. But while you see emptiness, at the same time you are able to see dependent arising, because there's dependent arising due to certain cause and conditions, there's a suffering. And there are some beings who are experiencing that suffering. And therefore, it allows you to feel compassion. You know, if you don't see that, then you see everything's, there's no sentient beings, sentient being empty, there is no suffering, then there's no space to feel compassion. But when you see emptiness, at the same time you see dependent arising, then that is, so that is how understanding the true truth simultaneously and same time help us to develop both wisdom and the method. And so, yeah, so maybe I will take a couple of questions. Yes, I think I can see three hands going up.
When someone's had perceptual realization of emptiness, and you've said then they see everything as an illusion, is that a short-term thing, or is that forever, whether they go back into a meditative state or not?
I think if they try to reinforce that meditation, then it can be forever. You know, but I think they have to be reinforced by that meditation time to time, you know. So I think that is why they do alternative meditation, post-meditations, you know. The meditations help the post-meditation, the appearance of everything as an illusory, like, dream-like, is during the post-meditations. And that is supported by the meditative state. And so when during the post-meditation, when you have that kind of more like an illusory or dream state, like, then again when you go into meditation, it also helps in your meditation as well, because there's no strong grasping due to that appearance. And so therefore, but also, you know, once you have direct perceptions of that, I haven't seen any clear in any scriptures about that cautions, that actually that, whether that happens all the times. Definitely when they are realizing emptiness, there's no more coming back, you know, when you reach certain points, when you have direct perception, definitely there's no more coming back. But in terms of the appearance of that illusory, like if the practitioner was in the meditative state for a couple of hours sometime, and then if they don't go in that meditative for days, weeks, months, whether that appearance appear, continue to appearance like an illusory or not, I'm not 100% sure. I cannot But I will imagine, because it does mention about alternating meditation and post-meditation all the time. So when you that alternate meditation and post-meditation, I think that meditation will keep you to have that appearance all the time, sustain that.
Thank you, Vishwa. Talking about emptiness of self and emptiness of phenomena, with the emptiness of emptiness, mm-hmm. can you give me an example of an analysis?
Uh-huh. When you talk about emptiness, we talk about emptiness of certain objects. We just can't just talk about emptiness that is not dependent on objects. When you talk emptiness, emptiness of self, emptiness of the body, emptiness of one of those aggregates, emptiness of the book, emptiness of table, whatever emptiness, it has to depend on some conventional phenomena. So therefore, without that conventional phenomena, there is no emptiness of that. When this iPad is normal, there is no more emptiness of this iPad. The emptiness of this iPad depends on this iPad. Okay? When this iPad is destroyed completely, and there is no more iPad, then there is no more emptiness of this iPad, because there is no more that iPad anymore. And so therefore, same with all the emptiness, they all depends on the objects of which emptiness that it is. So is it dependent arisings, you know. Also, one from that perspective, also the so-called emptiness is merely imputed on the basis of something that is merely absent of something, you know. So there's a nature of that the object is empty of inherent existence. On the basis of that object being empty of inherent existence, on the basis of that, then is labeled that as an emptiness. It's merely imputed, merely labeled. And also from that perspective, also it is a dependent arisings and is not inherent existence, truly existence. And I think the presentation of emptiness or emptiness is important because, again, we see emptiness as solution to all the problem, isn't it? We see the emptiness as the solution to the problems. It is the solution to end all the sufferings and the cause of suffering. And so when you see something as a solution to all the problem, all the suffering, then there is this possible sometimes we can have grasping to that. You know, and we might think, oh, this is the ultimate one. This is the ultimate one, and then we can have grasping to that. And so therefore, to let go of grasping to that, and it, then it's presented, even that is empty of inherent existence, truly existence, so that we don't have grasping to the solution itself.
Thank you, Geshe. So when you were saying that you understand simultaneously emptiness of an object and its dependent arising, is there a practical way we can think about that in terms of reducing our grasping applied to the delusions? How might that work?
Yeah. You know, then I think it comes to, yesterday we talked about understanding the conventional truth, subtle level of conventional truth or subtle level dependent arisings. And that is that how everything is merely imputed. How everything exists only on the basis of merely imputed. When you understand that everything, whatever objects, object of your attachment, object of your aversions, object of jealousy, object of our pride. You know, maybe we have pride because of certain qualities in ourselves, whatever the pride object. So whatever those delusions, when you those delusion arises on the basis of certain objects, you know, due to coming in contact with certain objects, then there is arising of either attachments or aversions or pride or jealousy, whatever. And so when we try to think on that, you know, of course, first you can think of, you know, analyze, the ultimate analysis, different reasoning logic that one can use to establish that they are not inherently existing as it appears to our mind, that there is no existing from its own side as it appears to our side. But at the same time, they do exist, and they exist on the basis of merely imputations. When you see something as existing on merely imputation, then it has both. Merely imputation, merely means it's a negate truly existence. But it exists by merely imputation. When you say merely imputation, then it says it exists by that. So then in that case, you find a middle way, you know. Merely, it exists by merely nominal or merely by label. So it doesn't reject the existence. At the same time, it negates the truly existing because of merely, it exists merely on nominal level. And that is the subtle level of understanding, more subtle level of dependent arising as well as the object to exist as a conventionally existence, as a false, as a deceptive. And to that, then you need to have first understanding emptiness. And so I think when we apply that, then you can see both and simultaneously in that way, when we are able to apply that. Okay?